Please be seated. Good morning. Delighted to welcome you all to the hearing room for Tuesday, September 14th, oral arguments. We have with us special guests. We have students from West Salem High School. Would they please stand? For coming, you may be seated. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. It's a program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from around the state to come to an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, we send them materials about the case. They may engage in some activities related to the case in their classrooms. They come to oral argument, and then after the second oral argument, there is a meeting with a justice, and a different justice is assigned each day to handle this presentation. And so we welcome you, West Salem. You will be joined by Xavier High School students and perhaps by some University of Wisconsin law students in your noon presentation. So we've met you. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and Justice Rogensack has just waved to you, will be the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, which is 08AP3007CR, State versus Brad E. Forbush. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Forbush is Craig A. Matsumoto. I pronounced every syllable. How do you say it quickly? Got it. All right, counsel. You may proceed. You have 25 minutes. Aaron O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state, will have 30 minutes, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, please, counsel.
Counsel, good morning. My name is Craig Mastantuno. My co-counsel is Rebecca Coffey, and we represent Petitioner Brad Forbush in this matter. Your Honors, as an attorney, I have always accepted as a given that the role of counsel acting on behalf of a client within our adversarial system is respected by not only courts but opposing counsel alike. The Court of Appeals decision in this case overturning this court's precedent in State versus Dagnall directly undermines that premise. In Wisconsin, attorneys have always been able to rely upon a simple rule when practicing in our trial courts that when undertaking representation of a client, notifying opposing counsel of that representation will suffice to prevent any further attempts by opposing counsel to communicate directly with that client. This rule preserves orderliness within the adversarial setting, an orderliness that is so crucial that the rule is seldom violated. This court affirmed that long-standing Wisconsin practice that I just spoke of when it issued its decision in State versus Dagnall. The state now urges you to overturn that decision, break with stare decisis, and overrule the Dagnall decision because of the United States Supreme Court's recent decision in Montejo versus Louisiana, and by implication resulting from that decision to also overturn this court's precedent in State versus Ward. Neither option is advisable. The state's position would reduce this court's role as the final arbiter of our state constitution to that of a court whose function is to simply follow the latest interpretations of the United States Supreme Court concerning constitutional rights that are common to both the United States Constitution and the Wisconsin Constitution, and then simply follow those interpretations. I suggest to this Honorable Court that that would result not only in a break from this Court's own precedent, but the policy underlying that precedent, and would have great implications affecting statewide practice in our criminal justice system.
Well, counsel, what do you want us to do with that United States Supreme Court decision?
Essentially, leave it there and leave this Court's prior precedent in place. Nothing would change, Justice Ziegler, in terms of current practice and law in Wisconsin if State versus Dagnall was now reaffirmed, if you will, by this Court using our own state's constitution, which wasn't addressed in the original Dagnall decision because it wasn't raised.
Okay. So a new federalism idea or something along those lines. State constitution gives greater protections and rights than the federal.
Yes. If I may, respectfully, the verbiage I would use is simply federalism. I believe it's been alive and well not only in this state but in other states, and is utilized, I believe, should be most utilized when state Supreme Courts believe that justice requires a different interpretation versus that of the United States Supreme Court. In this case, where we have a United States Supreme Court decision that essentially overturns its own precedent and this Court's precedent, I think that there is even a more, if you will, glaring reason for this Court to look carefully and consider whether to overturn its own decision, which really it had no need or reason to do prior to this latest United States Supreme Court decision.
Counsel, don't you think that it would be appropriate for us to go back and look at Dagnall and see what the basis was for the Dagnall decision?
I do, Your Honor, and I would urge this Court to do so. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that the basis underlying the Dagnall decision was a different rationale behind that which underlies the Louisiana versus Montejo decision of the United States Supreme Court.
Wasn't Dagnall based on Michigan versus Jackson, which really was an extension of the Edwards case? Isn't that the discussion that occurs for the majority in Dagnall?
Dagnall certainly paid adherence to Michigan versus Jackson, but also referenced the cases prior to Michigan versus Jackson that breathed a robust protection of the right for the role of counsel within our adversarial system once formal proceedings have been initiated. And I think, if I may, that the Dagnall Court went just a bit farther than the Michigan versus Jackson decision because it had to. It was based on a different factual scenario that did not involve the appointment of counsel at an initial appearance as in Michigan's system at the time, and was really based on the retention of counsel on behalf of the defendant. And the Dagnall decision referenced a particular provision that I've paid close attention to in my analysis, in that allowing for the provision for counsel to notify the authorities. I would quote, unless the authorities know the accused has an attorney, either the defendant or the defendant's counsel should advise the authorities of existence of counsel on the charge, which was exactly what was done by counsel by this office in this case. Dagnall referenced its factual scenario specifically. And I think rather than simply standing for the premise that since Michigan versus Jackson requires this system, it really stood for the premise that in order to preserve and respect the role of counsel in our courts, discourage police from trying to undermine that role or interfere with that relationship, the decision and the result in Dagnall was required and justified, and really in keeping with statewide practice that preceded the Dagnall decision. Having now set that precedent, I see little reason for this Court to change its policy rationale simply because the United States Supreme Court has done so in the Montejo decision.
Well, let me ask you this. You said something along these lines earlier. Dagnall was not based on the Wisconsin Constitution. There's no reference in Dagnall to a basis being the Wisconsin Constitution, is there?
No. You are correct about that, Justice Crooks. And Dagnall specifically noted that since neither party raised the issue of the state constitutional provision, it was not going to address that issue. I would posit that the policy rationale underlying the Dagnall decision just as easily is supported by adherence to the state constitution as to the United States Constitution.
Do you think there's been any confusion in the law between whether a case is a Fifth Amendment right to counsel case or a Sixth Amendment right to counsel case?
I do. Even in my review of existing case law and the arguments of counsel before appellate courts, I think that the issues are often confused. I do believe that the Montejo decision tends to make an attempt to eliminate some of those distinctions by lowering, if you will, the federal minimum standard floor of constitutional protection and saying that in a post-charging setting, that floor is now lowered to that which is equal to a Fifth Amendment pre-charging setting. That is not the remedy that I would suggest, and if I may say, Justice Crooks, it's not the remedy that you suggested in the State versus Ward decision, where you suggested elevating the standard from Fifth Amendment to Sixth Amendment.
Well, I certainly lamented over the confusion between Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment rights. I'm not so sure that I'd agree with you that that was the only approach I took, but I certainly lamented the situation.
What I would say with regard to the issue of confusion to this Court is that the Dagnell decision was well-reasoned, based on a sound policy, and set a clear directive, not only for defendants in criminal cases, but in my opinion, even more so for prosecution and law enforcement officers. It was a clear directive that simply stood for the premise that once the government initiates formal prosecution, the investigation and detection stage is presumed closed at that point. And so moving forward, in order for counsel to be able to engage in a meaningful fashion in representation of a client, direct contact with the litigant, the criminal defendant, would cease at that point. And that is very clear. That is not subject really to confusion. And that is why, as a practice, as a trial attorney primarily, it's always been taken as a given that notifying district attorney or opposing counsel in any form, via email, telephone call, notification in some other form, serves to put that attorney on notice. I represent this person now. We're going to assume that all communications shall be between counsel. And so that's not confusing at all. I would suggest that following the Montejo decision and taking that decision's dictates as to the federal minimum standard and the lowering of that standard, and now putting it onto Wisconsin state practice would lead to more confusion, not less, despite the Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment legal distinction.
I just want to clarify something. If we just apply the United States Supreme Court decision, you lose?
I believe that is correct.
Okay.
On the Dagnell.
I mean, I just straight out.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you had a gulp, but you lose. That's why you're putting it on the state constitution.
Yes.
Okay, just put that up front. Two, one of the issues in Ward, in the dissent, was that she was held incommunicado, whatever that means, and we tried to define that. In this case, your client said, may I make a telephone call, right?
Yes.
And the response was, in effect, no, not until we finish this.
That's correct.
Do you make the argument that, one, is it the practice of the police in this law enforcement to allow a telephone call?
I would never take that presumption as a given as a practitioner.
Okay.
I've certainly been on the other side of the wall, and co-counsel in this case was on the other side of the wall in this case where awaiting a court proceeding in this case, which also Mr. Forbush was not advised was about to occur.
Involving him?
Pardon me?
Involving Mr. Forbush?
I'm sorry.
Involving the defendant?
Yes.
This court proceeding?
Yes. His initial appearance in this case took place minutes after the interrogation was finished. In fact, I would suggest the record stands for the proposition that the initial appearance interrupted the interrogation, if you will. Mr. Forbush, the record is clear, was not advised that he was about to go to court for his initial appearance. After expressing doubt about whether to proceed with or without an attorney and speaking with the detective, he did indeed ask to make a telephone call. He was denied that request.
Was he advised that the counsel was in court awaiting him?
He was not.
Not advised. Just like in Ward.
Yes.
He was not advised.
Yes. And the record is
here, unlike in Ward, he did have counsel. I mean, he knew he had counsel.
He did have counsel, and counsel that has represented him from minutes after that interrogation ending, indeed, until today's proceeding consistently. I believe he was held incommunicado. I don't believe it is standard practice of police to afford an accused a telephone call upon demand, if you will, like I think we see from watching
That's
television.
That's only in the movies and television. You're entitled to one telephone call.
I think it is, Madam Chief, and I think it's because in real practice, there was a goal here, and the goal was to obtain a statement from Mr. Forbush. That was the goal, and what you see from reading not only the record, but I would encourage Your Honors to look at the DVD that was admitted into evidence of this 25-minute dialogue between Mr. Forbush and the detective. The goal was to get him to proceed without counsel, and I think it's very clear that the detective knew that once Mr. Forbush walked into court, sat down next to his attorney, that possibility was over.
The other thing that I hear is that if this were a civil case, state, I don't know about law enforcement, but state attorneys could not question or could not see your counsel without you. But what about if this were a civil case, could the state investigator see your client without counsel? Because you see in a criminal case other than a civil case, you've got a third party interest, namely the public here, represented by the state.
Yes. I think that the answer to that question may depend on whether or not formal proceedings have been initiated. Mm-hmm. I would suggest even in the regulatory scheme involving a civil matter that once a formal regulatory prosecution, if you will, of a civil nature, mm-hmm. I don't think that would be done, and I don't think that it should be done. And moving one step further in the civil arena, we take as a given that plaintiff's counsel would not call the doctor in a medical malpractice case directly and say, why don't you take this $300,000 settlement? It's the policy limit for the insurance coverage or something like that. And really, the policy underlying the reason I make reference to civil practice and criminal practice is the policy is the same. The policy is to prevent people from being taken advantage of once formal proceedings have been initiated. We presume that, despite level of education, expertise, dare I even say attorneys who are involved as litigants themselves because they have a bias, we're not prepared to deal with opposing counsel directly if we've chosen to be represented by counsel ourselves. That's the purpose.
One of the things that bothers me about a lockstep with the feds is if the feds change their mind, it creates havoc here. So we had, now I'm going to forget the issue in the case. Oh, it was the auto search case, the Belton auto search case. Our court took a tough line on auto searches. And the United States Supreme Court then issued Belton, which was widely interpreted as, hey, auto searches are generally okay. I'm overstating this somewhat. And then most recently, the U.S. Supreme Court said, "Ooh, you have misinterpreted us. Auto searches are not as widely allowed as you all have interpreted us." And then the result was evidence used in auto searches under what we call Belton then was bad evidence. And the question is opening up cases using unconstitutionally found evidence. So here now we've gotten a U.S. Supreme Court case, 5-4, right?
That's correct.
Saying you can use a confession made without counsel. Right?
In a post-charging setting.
And there's no showing that within 5 years, 3 years, 6 years, whatever, U.S. Supreme Court's going to say, that's not working too well. Stare decisis doesn't matter when it's not working well. Or we just disagree. Or it's been interpreted too widely. And now we think that the Sixth Amendment cases equivocal statement for counsel is good, or no questioning without getting a waiver from counsel, from the lawyer when the counsel is present, right? And that's going to throw other cases, past cases, in doubt, right?
It could.
Good.
I certainly would never counsel this court to follow a lockstep theory, but I don't think my opinion matters in that regard, because I think that the precedent of this court in this area certainly has never adhered to some type of lockstep theory in terms of following the latest United States Supreme Court dictates. Justice Scalia himself in the Montejo decision invites states to entertain this issue, stating that if a state wishes to abstain from requesting interviews with represented defendants, when counsel is not present, it may obviously continue to do so. And I would suggest this court made, this state made that choice 10 years before Montejo was decided. You made that choice. You were right for doing so. And we simply ask that Wisconsin current law be maintained. Nothing would change. And so, even more so in a case involving a change of this court's precedent, I would not counsel a lockstep theory versus the latest dictates of the United States Supreme Court.
Justice Gableman had a question.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Counsel, a few moments ago you made reference to the goal of the interview.
Yes.
The goal of the interview, as you described it, being to obtain a statement from your client. After watching the relevant parts of the interview, the 25 minutes leading up to the time your client wound up signing the statement indicating that he wanted to talk with law enforcement. To be comprehensive, isn't it fair to say that there were actually at least two goals in that interview? Didn't it seem to be fair? Didn't it seem that your client wanted to get his version out to law enforcement?
I think that may be a fair summation, Justice Gibson, but may I...
Isn't that what he said?
I think that Mr. Forbush was involved in a 25-minute period of active equivocation. I don't think he knew what he wanted to do. I think he was considering two choices.
But one of the ways that we tell what people want is by what they say, and during the interview, your client did indicate, my recollection of the interview is your client did indicate he wanted to get his version out to law enforcement.
I think that Mr. Forbush's, if I may disagree just a bit with Your Honor, I think that he expressed the desire of potentially moving forward and also expressed fear about doing so without counsel. And I think it's, if we're weighing goals, I think it's significant to note that every time Mr. Forbush referenced a question of the detective or expressed some clear doubt, the response, and I would encourage the court to pay attention, was to redirect, if you will, Mr. Forbush.
I can assure you this member of the court has paid attention. And I think what you're about to say, and if you're not, it'll be a few steps or a few questions down, so let's get to it, is every time he equivocated or every time he started to tell his version of events, the officer, nor Detective Norlander, responded by saying, that's great, but first I need you to sign this waiver if you want to talk.
I need to do this, yes. Or would opine with regard to, in my 17 years of law enforcement, it's always best to get two sides of the story out there.
Sure.
And so I think that if we're weighing the goals, I think this is post-charging, Justice Gableman, and I'm sorry, I know that you've paid attention to the record. I was going to suggest that you pay attention to the responses as a group, but I appreciate the court's attention to the record. But I think that if we're weighing goals, this is in a post-charging setting. What we really want to address is that, you know, we say in case law the government is a sophisticated adversary, a powerful adversary, and the agent of the government in this case has certainly been there many more times than Mr. Forbush, understands...
Your client was not inexperienced with the criminal justice system, however.
I don't believe that's correct.
Are there some prior convictions in his past?
No, I don't believe. I think there may be one misdemeanor conviction. I don't think the record is clear on with regard to his experience in the custodial interrogative setting. But what I would suggest is certainly the detective was much more of a skilled practitioner within this setting. Combine that with the lack of advising Mr. Forbush about the larger setting that he was in. We're in a room next to the courtroom. You're about to go to court. It appears that there's an attorney waiting for you there. I don't think it's tasteful to prevent somebody from knowing something, if you will, by neither volunteering information or redirecting his queries or denying him a phone call, and then blame or fault him to some extent with not having that knowledge. It doesn't speak of fair play. And while we're used to, in the Fifth Amendment setting, some acceptance of this, even misrepresentations, not allowing an attorney to come in when standing on the other side of the wall, in a post-charging setting, we presume that we've shifted from investigative to adversarial, and so there's a more robust protection of a person in Mr. Forbush's rights. And that's what Dagnell spoke to in addressing the situation in 2000.
Can you distinguish the Forbush case on the facts in any way from the Montejo case?
Well, in the Montejo case, we certainly have the issue that arose was the appointment of counsel that was automatic in Louisiana and not as a result of a request of the defendant at the initial appearance in response to the trial court. And so both parties, or neither party, if you will, suggested that that should mean that Michigan versus Jackson should be overturned. The court, on oral argument, suggested that that issue be revisited, and indeed supplemental briefing was ordered, and then the Supreme Court issued its 5-4 decision. In terms of a factual distinction, I don't believe that the principles that Dagnell supports are distinguished by the facts as opposed to Montejo. I think there are factual distinctions, but I don't believe that they are relevant or germane to the underlying inquiry, which is a post-charging setting, the government being aware of the representation of counsel and then attempts by agents to do an end run around that representation. I think those principles remain the same despite any factual distinctions.
Counsel, I understand your argument to be that Dagnell survives the Montejo decision, and then going into Article 1, Section 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution. But I also understand that you have an alternative argument that Dagnell survives because it protects the attorney-client relationship.
Yes, I see. My argument is that Dagnell should survive the Montejo decision and that this court should reaffirm that decision based on state constitutional principle, Justice Bradley. The reason I quibbled when Madam Chief suggested that I lose if Dagnell is not followed, I would agree with that in a larger picture. But I guess my alternative is also that we had an equivocal request for counsel here, that given this court's recent decision in State versus Ward, which suggests that equivocal requests for counsel in the Sixth Amendment setting are still sufficient post-charging to invoke that right, that there's a more limited basis for granting Mr. Forbush upholding the trial court's decision. And the Court of Appeals really didn't address that issue.
If the court held against you, would it have to do something about that language in Ward?
Would it have to do so, what, Madam Chair?
Would it have to withdraw or change or explain away that language in Ward?
I think so. I think that if Mr. Forbush is not granted relief before this court in any form, it would require that court to withdraw that language in Ward. Yes, I would agree with that. And if I may, I would say just with regard to that issue, we really get, for lack of a better expression, hung up to an extent on verbiage when it comes to equivocal versus unequivocal requests for counsel. And what I would say about that is I think that the state is going to urge you to find that this didn't even rise to the level of equivocation, this 25-minute dialogue. The definition, just from Merriam-Webster, is subject to two or more interpretations of equivocal. This certainly was subject to two or more interpretations. Either Mr. Forbush was going to proceed with counsel or he was going to proceed without counsel. And that 25-minute dialogue, the sole purpose of that dialogue, the reason it continued, was to determine which of those two outcomes Mr. Forbush would proceed along. And so I suggest that that entire process was an active, equivocal process. And the detective, indeed, himself knew that, which is why the waiver form wasn't ultimately signed until that equivocation ended.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Aaron O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Aaron O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state. The state is asking this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision in this case, holding that law enforcement did not violate Mr. Forbush's right to counsel under either the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution or Article 1, Section 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution when they interrogated him after he had been charged and assuming that he had been represented by counsel when they conducted the interrogation. Specifically, The state is asking that this court hold that neither the Wisconsin Constitution nor the federal Constitution prohibits police from approaching charged and represented defendants and interrogating them, provided that law enforcement obtains a valid waiver of the defendant's Miranda rights. The state is also asking this court to hold that to invoke the right to counsel during a custodial interrogation under the Sixth Amendment and Article I, Section 7, that a defendant must unequivocally invoke that right to counsel. Montejo v. Louisiana governs both of these issues for Sixth Amendment purposes, and the state is asking that this court apply that case's rationale to the state constitution as well, and therefore to hold that because the police obtained a valid waiver from Mr. Forbush and he did not unequivocally invoke his right to counsel during the interrogation, that his statement was properly obtained.
Could I ask, is there any factual distinction between this case and the Dagnall case?
There is. In Dagnall, there was communication between the defendant's attorney and the district attorney's office, and there was undisputably in this case as well. The difference between this case and Dagnall is that the defendant was aware that he had an attorney in that case and that he let the state know when the police came to interrogate him, or went to pick him up in Florida, I should say, and they interrogated him, that he had counsel. He said, my attorney told me not to talk to you guys. In that case, you can assume that the defendant had an existing attorney-client relationship, that under the holding of Michigan versus Jackson, that the police were obligated to respect. And in this case, there is only communication between the defendant's counsel and the district attorney's office, but there's no indication, and I think a review of the interrogation in its entirety reveals that Mr. Forbush had no idea he was represented by counsel or that counsel purported to represent him.
Didn't his brother-in-law say you're going to get a lawyer at the other side?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the brother-in-law, who was the lawyer who represented him in Michigan?
Yes.
That's this case?
Yes, that is.
Didn't he say you're going to have a lawyer at the other side? Other side meaning the other side of the border between Michigan and... Pardon me?
I'm sorry, I'm not really understanding the question. Are you saying that his brother told him that he had a lawyer?
I'm saying that he was aware he was going to get a lawyer, right?
I don't think the record reveals that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, so it's more like Ward then?
Yes, I think this situation is comparable to Ward, although I don't think... In the Ward case, we had an attorney trying to get in to see his client, and I don't think that that was necessarily the case here.
You indicated in your argument that the interrogation here did not violate the Sixth Amendment and did not violate the Wisconsin Constitution. Did it violate the Dagnall decision?
I don't believe it did because of that factual difference that you asked about earlier. The fact that there was, I don't think the record reveals that there was an existing attorney-client relationship. Under the Dagnall rule, and I admit that Dagnall, I think, supports both of our arguments. There's language in the decision that does support the defense's argument that a phone call to the district attorney is enough to assert the right to counsel on behalf of a defendant. But I would suggest that in interpreting Dagnall, we have to look what actually happened there. And there's also language that suggests that a defendant has to let the state know of the existence of the attorney-client relationship during a custodial interrogation that case doesn't use the term invoke the right, but just to let the state know about it.
In this case, the state knew that Mr. Forbush had an attorney.
The district attorney knew that someone called him and saying they were going to represent him, yes.
Did the district attorney not share that information?
I don't believe he did. There's nothing clear in the record saying what the district attorney said to Detective Norlander, but Detective Norlander did testify at the suppression hearing that the only counsel he was aware of in this case was that his brother in Michigan, but there wasn't any indication that the district attorney had communicated the information regarding the phone call to Detective Norlander before the interrogation occurred.
So should the state be rewarded for the failure to communicate that information to the detective?
No, I don't think the state is being rewarded for failing to communicate that information. I don't.
Well, let's see. The law as you want it to be, Mr. Forbush did know that he had an attorney.
Yes.
And suppose that attorney was right outside the door, the other side of the wall. Can the detective continue to question the defendant?
If the detective is aware that there's an attorney outside, I think this is the difference between the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, and that if you do have counsel, if the situation in Ward had occurred after charging, I believe, and I'm referencing, there's a footnote in Patterson versus Illinois, saying that the situation in Moran versus Burbine, which was very similar to the situation in Ward, where they were interrogating someone and not letting counsel get in, they said that wouldn't fly under the Sixth Amendment because the Sixth Amendment protects a greater right to protect the attorney-client relationship. Now, in this case, again, we don't believe there was an attorney-client relationship, so perhaps in this case it wouldn't have been, the detective would have had to let counsel in had he been trying to get in unless the defendant invoked. But if the detective was aware of this, and the applicable rule was Montejo, in that the state was aware that there was counsel, but under Montejo are still allowed to attempt to interrogate a defendant. If the defendant's counsel is waiting outside, I think that the police have to let him in.
You think the police what?
Have to let him in.
Where do you find that?
Patterson versus Illinois, there's a footnote that suggests that what
happened. That survived Montejo?
I believe it does.
Let me ask.
Go ahead.
Mr. Forbush allegedly commits this offense in Sheboygan.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to Michigan.
Yes.
And he's represented by his brother.
Yes.
And then he waives extradition and comes back to Sheboygan.
Right.
Is it your position that his brother never told him that he was going to arrange to have counsel in Wisconsin?
I think there's a suggestion that during the interrogation that he references something about his brother was going to get him counsel, yes. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that there was any sort of follow-up on that Mr. Forbush, you know, heard from his brother that I got you this attorney and he's there waiting for you.
Okay, but there was an attorney who had weighed in on this. That's right.
Yes.
That attorney right there.
Yes. I don't know, and the record doesn't, I think, reveal how he got involved, but I think the conclusion is that Mr. Forbush personally did not retain counsel.
Okay, so let's find out what the rule is that the state wants, right? Charges are filed, right, in this case. Charges are filed. An attorney has weighed in with the DA.
Correct.
We don't know whether the DA has weighed in with the police, and maybe the law enforcement is an agent of the DA at this stage or not, and maybe there's common knowledge. We're not going to get there for the moment. Okay. So the attorney has weighed in. Initial appearance is momentary, going to happen, and the attorney is in court prepared to represent him. But that the defendant here doesn't know the name of the lawyer, is that right?
Doesn't, I don't think, know about the existence of the lawyer.
Okay. And doesn't know the existence of the lawyer. And this falls under the Sixth Amendment, right? And your position is that under these conditions, the law enforcement can question the defendant without counsel. And unless the defendant makes an unequivocal demand for a lawyer,
yes,
questioning can continue.
That's correct.
Okay, let's change the facts a little. Defendant knows there's a lawyer that's been hired for him. Told the brother, except whatever he hires, hasn't necessarily met the lawyer. Same fact situation. Can law enforcement continue questioning the, can law enforcement initiate questioning of this defendant without counsel present?
Under the rule we're proposing, under Montejo versus Louisiana, yes, they can.
They can.
Yes.
Right. So whether if the defendant knows he's got a lawyer, has a lawyer, spoken to the lawyer, law enforcement can question.
That's correct.
So one would think that if he doesn't know that he has a lawyer, law enforcement can question him too.
That's correct.
That's it.
Yes.
So the state's advocating an across-the-board rule that after charges are filed, whether the defendant knows he's got a lawyer or not, whether he's spoken to a lawyer or not, whether the cops know he's got a lawyer or not, whether the DA knows he's got a lawyer or not, they can question him. And unless there's an unequivocal statement, I want my lawyer and I'm not going to talk to you.
That's correct.
They can continue questioning.
Counsel, have you searched to see whether any Court of Appeals cases rely on Article 1, Section 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution in addition to the Sixth Amendment?
Any Court of Appeals cases?
Mm-hmm.
As far as I've seen, in this custodial interrogation context,
yes.
I think the only one is the Court of Appeals decision in this case that discusses both of them. I have not seen any other cases.
Nobody else has talked about it.
As far as I've uncovered, and this Court's decisions as well, in the custodial interrogation context, post-charging.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Counsel, I want to take the Chief's fact situations and move it a step further.
Sure.
I want to put on my hat as a circuit court judge, and I'm a circuit court judge, and there's the defendant, and the defendant has already been brought into court on the charges. Let's say the defendant has had a preliminary hearing, and he remains in jail, in custody, pending trial. Under your, and he's represented at the initial appearance by an attorney, and the same attorney as a prelim, and under your bright line rule, may law enforcement start talking to him and continue questioning him unless he makes an unequivocal request for his lawyer?
I think Montejo suggests that they can.
Yeah, that's what I understand your argument to be.
Yes.
So now we take the guy, the defendant, and we've gone through suppression motions, and it's 9 months later, and he's still in jail. No matter what time and how far we've gone through with the defendant, law enforcement can go into the jail, talk to a defendant who's been represented by counsel all along for months and months and months, and say, gee, what did you think about that Packer game last Saturday? Pretty good stuff, huh? And then start the conversation and then start talking as long as they get a unequivocal request for a lawyer. Can they continue then interrogating him?
Yes, I think Montejo says that, but I don't think that this is ever very likely to happen.
We've had cases where they've gone to prison and raised lots of questions.
We are talking about a defendant in your scenario, you know, eve of trial. During trial, the police would try to interrogate them. I really think that's very unlikely to happen. First, we have a client who has an attorney. He's had an attorney at all his court appearances. As an attorney, he's being advised with preparing defense strategy. The first thing that attorney is going to tell him, do not talk to the police whatsoever. If they try to talk to you, say, I want my lawyer. Do not talk to them. That's the first thing the lawyer is going to tell their client. I think we also have to look at sort of the practical situations of what happens. How much is law enforcement interested in talking to a defendant past the initial phases of an investigation? I mean, what happened here in this case was still very early in the police investigation. The reason charges were filed was because the defendant went to Michigan. This was the first opportunity that law enforcement had to talk to him. In some respects, the defendant got a windfall because he went to Michigan. He had more rights than a defendant who had stayed in the state and even maybe turned himself in to the police once they knew he was looking for them.
In Montejo, wasn't the defendant, didn't the defendant give a confession before he was even charged?
Yes, that's correct.
So, I mean, your theory that the police will not be interested in following up even after the charge doesn't seem to be I'm not persuaded by that argument.
Well, that's correct. But in Montejo, again, the counsel had only been appointed, had not met with his client. I think that the mitigation, I guess, if you will, of having counsel actually meet with the client and telling him to be quiet is going to prevent, you know, the sort of, I think, harassment that
So the Michigan counsel, the defendant's own brother, probably didn't tell him to be quiet. Is that right?
I don't know what his brother told him.
Counsel, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the requirement in the state's view for the unequivocal request for an attorney at these stages of the proceedings post-charging. In this matter, I assume a complaint had been filed as part of the initiation for the extradition proceedings after Mr. Forbush fled to Michigan. Would you please describe the legal basis that the state sees for the requirement of an unequivocal request for an attorney?
Certainly. I think foremost, under the Sixth Amendment, it's clear in Montejo, when they remanded the case for a hearing of whether Montejo, he claimed he had invoked his right to counsel during the hearing, and the state court had not decided that issue. And in remanding, they identified the standard for invocation as a clear and unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel. That is also the standard that governs Fifth Amendment invocations, and it's the standard that this Court has recognized for Fifth Amendment invocations as well.
I guess I'd like to ask one of the questions that comes to mind in the discussion of whether you call it federalism or new federalism. And as your opposing counsel points out, Justice Scalia inviting states to state courts, such as this court, to look at having different standards. Why in the state's estimation, would it be a bad idea for this court to afford to find in its own state constitution rights that are more protective of people who are in Mr. Forbush's position at this stage of the proceedings? Why would that be a bad idea in the state's estimation?
I don't think necessarily it's a bad idea, and this court obviously has the authority to interpret the Wisconsin Constitution more broadly than the federal constitution, but I think any decision to do that has to be based in the law, and I don't see anything in the law that would support such a conclusion in this case. The methods of interpreting the state constitution are you look at the text and the history and, you know, past decisions interpreting this provision.
And the similarity to similar provisions in the United States Constitution.
Right. And this court has held that, in general, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and the right to counsel under Article 1, Section 7 are, for the most part, identical. There's no case law in the state interpreting Article 1, Section 7 to prohibit the interrogation of represented defendants who've been charged with a crime. And, in fact, the case law in the state before Michigan versus Jackson, which prohibited interrogating represented and charged defendants, I think any fair reading of it suggests that it was a permissible practice, and admittedly those cases did not address the Wisconsin Constitution.
And so that like provisions in the state's estimation between the Wisconsin Constitution and the United States Constitution ought to be interpreted in like manner.
Correct.
Counsel, do you have a backup position? I understand that your response to my earlier question was law enforcement may continue to interrogate someone in custody who's post-charging and post-appearance and post-prelim and can interrogate them as long as the defendant does not unequivocally request for the attorney to be present.
That's correct.
That's your position.
Yes.
Do you have a lesser position than that?
Do you mean if this court interprets the Wisconsin Constitution consistently with Dagnall? Yes, we do. If this If Dagnall is going to remain the law in Wisconsin, there are two issues that this court has to resolve. And a yes answer to either one of these questions requires suppression. The first is, was Mr. Forbush represented by counsel when he was approached for the interrogation?
Say that again.
I'm sorry. The first question is whether Mr. Forbush was represented by counsel when he was approached for interrogation. And the second question is whether Mr. Forbush invoked his right to counsel equivocally. That is the law in Wisconsin, absent Montejo.
Did he invoke unequivocally?
Equivocally.
Equivocally, okay, because this is a Sixth Amendment. That's the footnote in Ward. Okay.
It's our position that Montejo changes the Sixth Amendment rule on that by identifying unequivocal as the standard, but yes. With respect to the first issue of whether Mr. Forbush is represented, I think I already touched on this, but there wasn't the purpose, if you read Dagnall, is that the Sixth Amendment requires protection of the attorney-client relationship. And when there is no attorney-client relationship, there is nothing to protect. And I don't think the facts of this case reveal that there was an attorney-client relationship here. In Dagnall, the court looked not only to counsel's phoning the district attorney's office, or I believe it was a letter in that case, and saying we represent Mr. Dagnall, but also Dagnall's assertion to the police when he was picked up and they tried to interrogate him, my attorney doesn't want me to talk to you. That, the court found, evinced a attorney-client relationship, and this court specifically noted that Mr. Dagnall was aware that he had an attorney. And there's really nothing in this record to support a similar conclusion here. If you review the interrogation in its entirety, it's pretty clear to me that Mr. Forbush had no idea that counsel was purporting to represent him. And without an attorney-client relationship, there can be nothing to protect under the Sixth Amendment.
Mr. O'Neill, didn't the circuit judge here make a finding to the effect that at the time of interrogation of Forbush that he was represented by counsel?
I believe the circuit court did, absolutely.
Isn't the review of that kind of a finding by the circuit judge one of erroneous exercise of discretion?
I've been thinking about this, and I don't know how to characterize it. I don't know that it's necessarily a factual conclusion based on the fact of its legal significance. The idea that, if you look at the facts being that defense counsel called the district attorney's office and said we represent him, I don't think that leads to the legal conclusion that he had a lawyer. I think that leads to the conclusion that the defense counsel called the district attorney's office and indicated they were representing him. And if it is a factual finding, I would suggest it is erroneous based on the fact that all we have is this phone call.
Let me ask you one other question. We've got another case that's sort of in the background of all of this, a court of appeals case, State versus Horning.
Correct.
How does that fit with the state's approach here?
I believe Horning says that it's an equivocal invocation is permissible. And under that approach, if this court is going to continue with the Dagnall approach and the footnote in Ward saying that an equivocal invocation is correct, that is the law. But I think the issue becomes, well, what's even an equivocal request? And it has to be some, as counsel said, indication subject to two different interpretations that the person wants counsel. And I don't think that anything that Mr. Forbush said here really evinces any desire to have counsel. There's quite a bit of back and forth between him and Detective Norlander, but in those conversations, there's nothing that ever says, maybe I should have a lawyer. That's an equivocal invocation. Asking, do you think I should have a lawyer? That's an equivocal invocation. Saying, well, if I had a lawyer, it might be okay, or if I had a lawyer, it means this, but I can't do everything through lawyers. That's just sort of a defendant weighing his options, and the law doesn't prohibit the defendant from being forced to weigh his options about whether he wants to proceed with an attorney.
How would this court phrase a test if we were to say it's perfectly okay if there is an equivocal assertion of counsel or invocation of counsel, what would the test be? What are the parameters of an equivocal request?
Sure. I think, and this is taken from this court's decision in Jennings based on U.S. v. Davis, that there is has to be some indication that of a possible desire that the defendant is exercising the right to counsel, or they put it another way, a reasonable officer would have understood that the defendant might be invoking his right to counsel. It's a very, I agree, tricky standard to apply, and which is why we're advocating for an unequivocal invocation, because it makes things much easier to just say, I want a lawyer. It resolves any confusion in the law.
As I read Montejo, Justice Scalia says, heck, we get a real problem nationally. In some states like Louisiana, and this was a Louisiana case, the court automatically appoints counsel, right?
Yes.
In other states, there we were talking about an indigent, and it was appointed state. Isn't that right, Montejo?
In Montejo, yes.
In other states with indigents, this is Scalia talking, he says the defendant has to ask for a lawyer.
Correct.
And Louisiana makes the distinction between the court appointing and the guy accepting or not, or the defendant asking for it. And Scalia says the United States Constitution can't be determined that it's federal constitutional rights on whether you ask or that it's an automatically appointed. And it seems to me the state's position here is that your constitutional rights depend on whether there is a lawyer who thinks they represent you and whether or not the defendant accepts that representation, right?
For under Dagnall, yes.
Yeah. And isn't that a distinction that Scalia objected to?
Absolutely.
In Montejo. So Scalia would say you treat them both the same.
Right.
And then, if that's true, you would treat them the same, you'd say they're represented by counsel. Because that's what Scalia said here.
Correct.
So your position, your backup position, was he represented by counsel, would, if you apply the underpinning of Montejo, the answer is yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And did he invoke equivocally? I don't know. Does Montejo deal with that?
Only to the extent it identifies it as the standard that the state court was supposed to apply on remand. It says unequivocally and clear invocation.
Unequivocally.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I agree that my argument under Dagnall is confusing, and it makes a lot of unnecessary distinctions. But to me, that's the reason to accept Montejo, because it identifies a clear rule that can be followed.
Counselor, do you think Montejo then also addresses one's constitutional right to represent themselves? We've talked a lot about the right to have representation through an attorney. But you also have a constitutional right to represent yourself. And so if Montejo means that you need to either invoke your right to have a lawyer represent you or exercise your right to represent yourself, I've always operated under the Dagnall rule, and I thought it worked really well. And it appeals to me, just so we're on an even playing field, because I think it made sense. You know, you call the DA, I represent this person, don't talk to him. Makes sense to me. But Montejo looks at it differently, and then when you try to weigh those competing rights, the right to represent yourself, which is equal to the right to be represented by a lawyer, maybe Montejo says the person who needs to make that call is the defendant.
I think that's what it does say. I, regardless of whether counsel is appointed at an initial court appearance, you know, the defendant can choose to, under Montejo, go alone at a subsequent custodial interrogation. We also have the concern that a third party getting an attorney involved when the defendant doesn't want an attorney, wants to exercise his right to self-representation, or a co-defendant wants to get the defendant to shut up, hires an attorney for him, and ensures his silence by getting a counsel that maybe the defendant wants to confess.
I think that's a very interesting concept, that you allow the defendant to represent himself at the questioning. But ordinarily, if a defendant's going to represent himself in court, isn't there a colloquy between the judge and the defendant so that the court is assured that the defendant understands the implications of representing himself, that the defendant understands the charge, the penalty, difficulties, or at least the steps involved for representing themselves? And it's, unless the defendant can show that, is the court going to let him represent himself?
No. And
so here you're going to let him represent himself, but there's no such colloquy.
There is a Miranda waiver.
Pardon me?
There are, the defendant has to be advised of his rights to counsel and his right to remain silent.
That's
and
all.
That is because in this context, in the custodial interrogation context, the role of counsel at a custodial interrogation really doesn't change whether the defendant is charged. At trial, it's much more important rights involved.
But it doesn't fit the concepts we have of self-representation.
Not for getting a waiver at a trial or a court proceeding, yes.
Okay.
But in our state anyway, and in many states, it's not as if you always have a lawyer until you waive your lawyer either. You decide how you're going to proceed, and then a court may appoint counsel, you may hire counsel, you may go on your own, and a waiver in court is different than, for example, a waiver and Miranda, as that's been applied for a long time in a custodial setting or in an interrogation setting. I mean, the court would have to be careful not to unwind years of Miranda law and practice in an interrogation setting. True?
I think that's correct, yes.
Is that your answer?
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
I think that it's hard to appreciate as we sit here, and it will be determined for the years coming, how far-reaching the effect of the decision in Louisiana versus Montejo goes. Because I think if we put on our trial judge hats, and I would try to do so as well for purposes of hypothetical, up until and during the trial, and on the eve of trial or other contested proceedings subsequent to the initiation of litigation, there is an incentive by law enforcement to speak to obtain information. We see that in jailhouse snitch cases and other attempts by law enforcement to gain an advantage in litigation and an advantage in the subject of the litigation in a criminal case, the charge itself. And so this will go on. And Montejo authorizes it because Montejo says the only thing that matters is what the defendant does in response to an attempt to custodially interrogate him or her at that time. Doesn't matter what the lawyer does. So all of that practice of notifying counsel and presuming that communication will be through counsel once formal charges are initiated is out the door. And I think you can't underestimate the importance. It's true that we have allowed people to represent themselves in interrogative settings with law enforcement officers and even district attorneys outside of the formal litigation process. But I think that is a marker that's very clear. Once a complaint is filed, once formal proceedings are initiated, that serves as a very clear directive. And I think it does so for many purposes that we've discussed. I'd like to just touch on one additional purpose I think that would be prevented by maintaining Dagnall, the directive in Wisconsin, the directives of Dagnall in Wisconsin. Subsequent to the initiation of formal proceedings, it's certainly possible that the type of communication sought by law enforcement or prosecution agents is different than that during the Fifth Amendment setting investigation detection stage. A charge has already been filed. And so there's nothing to prevent in the Montejo decision law enforcement personnel from approaching to not only obtain information from the defendant, but to persuade the defendant to have a clear goal, to advise the defendant. Two co-defendants have pled in your case, and they're going to get probation in their case, or one co-defendant is saying that you did this and that. And that type of interrogation or statements designed to elicit a response, if you will, not only has an investigative or detection goal, but can result in exactly what the rule prohibiting contact with represented persons directly by opposing counsel was meant to prevent, which was to gain an advantage in litigation. I see nothing, given the new directives of Louisiana versus Montejo, to prevent that other than the defendant in a post-charging setting electing unequivocally, according to the state's interpretation of Montejo, to be represented by counsel at that moment. And within the crucible of contested litigation in a criminal court setting, with the state's ability to take physical control of a person, isolate him or her, present themselves as experts or authority, I don't think we can underestimate the powerful tool that is now being given to the government in that type of setting. And I agree that it would be a waiver of counsel in a post-charging setting that courts are very careful to examine in court, that once somebody has elected to be represented, that a waiver of that right subsequently is carefully examined by trial courts before allowing somebody to proceed. I would also suggest that the state seems to invite a test, if you will, of whether counsel actually represented. And I think that this would go on further if Dagnell was overturned, that, a phone call notifying the DA is not sufficient to presume representation. What else is not sufficient to presume representation, particularly where counsel are unable to talk to their client because they're in a transport vehicle coming around the pond to Sheboygan, where an initial appearance is scheduled for the very same morning of arrival, and where nobody but the state really has the ability to say, I'm going to go over to the jail, I'm going to take that physical control of that person, I'm going to bring him to an isolated room, I'm going to prevent him from contacting others, and I'm going to interrogate that person because we know we have an initial appearance coming up, and we're not going to tell the defendant that, but we've got to get it in before then. And the detective testified to that at the motion hearing, that that was what he was doing. That's why he manipulated the timing of this all. That's why he went right after roll call over to the jail facility and brought Mr. Forbush back.
If I said that the result of Montejo is to make the Fifth Amendment cases now applicable to the Sixth Amendment cases, is that too broad? Is that a relatively accurate statement?
No, Madam Chief, I don't think that's too broad. I think that is a relatively accurate statement. Absolutely.
Fifth and Sixth become the same, but you apply the Fifth Amendment rules now.
Correct. And the only person that can raise that shield, if you will, even in a post-charging setting, is the defendant himself or herself. No one else. Nothing else matters. If the court will indulge me with 20 seconds, I would...
20 seconds, but I'm watching the
clock. I was recently up north on a case subsequent to the Montejo decision, and in a homicide case that was high profile, and dealing with the elected district attorney, I asked whether, since charges had already been filed and a statement had not been obtained, he was going to attempt to obtain a statement through his agents. He distastefully replied in the negative, I would never do that. I reminded him of the recent decision in Montejo, and he said, despite that decision's directives, I would just never do that. That's not to suggest that lawyers won't attempt this, but that is to suggest that they shouldn't be authorized, nor should their agents. We find this distasteful. The rules of fair play are in place, and I just suggest that they remain the same. Thank you very much.
May I?
I listened. It was 45 seconds. Go ahead.
I apologize.
May I ask you, what do you represent as Mr. Forbush's state of mind about you or counsel at the time he was being interrogated?
I would represent that Mr. Forbush knew that his brother represented him in Michigan and that he knew that he was going to have an attorney and that he's kind of all over the place in his statements in that regard. I would also, though, say that that should only be examined in light of the state's tactics in preventing him from ascertaining further information in that regard. And in the Dagnell decision itself, it said to rule otherwise would be to invite the state on a series of blandishments or inducements for the goal of preventing that knowledge, and that the state shouldn't avoid discovery of that knowledge nor engage in the type of behavior towards somebody in the custodial interrogative setting post-charging that was done in Dagnell, and I think to a higher degree in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. I want to, on behalf of the Court, thank you and the Assistant Attorney General for excellent arguments in a very timely and important issue. That concludes our hearing in 08-AP-3007-CR, State versus Forbush. The Court will take a short recess so the students may leave if they wish and the additional students may come into the courtroom.